Hey.
Come on now. And now it's time for off-season reviews. And now your host, Rod or Cam.
Or both of them.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Off Season Reviews. I'm your host Rod. Today I am joined by my man Lamont, who you guys might know from Brown Skin and Glasses podcast. One half of that duo. You might know him from his Twitter, LS Rules. What's going on, Lamont?
Man, I'm chilling. I'm ready to do my lyric. Here we go. Who the fuck is this? Paging me. 5:46 in the morning. Crack a donin. Now I'm yawning. Wipe the cold out my eye. Okay.
I'm glad you can make it. And I'm glad you're very excited. This is, you know, speaking of warnings, this is a show where we're going to have some spoilers. So guys, if, you know, you don't want to be spoiled on True Detective, hurry up and get the fuck out. All right. It's, This we're gonna talk about the whole season. Off season reviews where we recap pretty much a show during the break of the show. Like I got tired of listening to episode by episode recaps of shows. People talk way too fucking long about a show. They talk longer than the episode of the show was. And
okay.
You know, I didn't need all that speculation. I like to get the narrative complete, know what happened, and then I can actively judge it without feeling like they didn't get a proper representation, right? So
I feel you.
We're going to go ahead and do that today for True Detective, HBO's own True Detective. Creator Nick Pizzolatto, and starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson and Michelle Monaghan. Pretty star-studded cast, you know, for an HBO show. And it's basically about two detectives, Rust Cole and Martin Hart, who become entangled during a 17-year hunt for a serial killer in Louisiana.
Can we first mention how, okay, now you got your intro and everything, but this is how you know this show is getting like a critical dick sucking, in the fact that the lead characters' names are Hart and Cole. Like, if this was like a shitty movie, they'd be like, oh, okay, his name is Hart, his name is Cole. Together, they're Hart and Cole, and people would be dissing the shit and all snarky as hell about it. This is how you know it is pretty much critique-proof, and it's one of these things that is doing no wrong in people's eyes. Well, so, more or less.
Well, I was thinking, one, it's funny because they put the H in Cole.
Yeah.
C-O-H-L-E. Which is, you know, a definite movie trope where you're like, well, we can't have it Smith. Put a Y in there.
No. And if it was Smith, it would be S-M-Y-T-H-E.
Exactly. Yeah. Throw a Y and an E on the Smith. You know, he's too different for that. Also, I thought it didn't catch enough flack for Woody Harrelson and Michelle Monaghan's names being Marty and Maggie Hart.
What was that?
You know, they're both M's. You know, Marty and Maggie is almost like, you know, well, let's just give it another name. She's not important. Why don't you give it another M? Give people something easy to remember.
Okay. I didn't pick up on that. But I mean, there's things you do with alliterations with, you know, characters, you know, Peter Parker, Clark Kent, you know, you put that stuff to the side a little bit.
Yeah.
Plus, if you're watching True Detective, women don't really matter anyway. That's one of the complaints I keep seeing. I don't know. There's a story about a bunch of dudes chasing down a bunch of kitty fuckers. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it was. I have heard that too. That women get kind of tossed to the side in this show. But I feel like everyone gets tossed to the side. Like, I couldn't tell you the names of the two black detectives who are now the lead investigators on this case.
I can tell you, Rod. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's Brothers Muzzone and Leroy from Sons of Anarchy. Okay.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know. All right. No, but their names are Gilbo and Papineau or something. But I only know that because I looked it up, because when we started doing this, I started doing a little bit of research. Because ultimately, like, as I was just telling you, my watching this, I didn't watch it from the beginning. I wasn't going week by week. I got into it. And interestingly, I was when I passed through, I heard about it. People were like, oh, you gotta watch. And I was like, ah, maybe I'll get into it, whatever. And then when I passed through one time, it happened to be on episode 4 on that awesome long ass shot in the hood, which we'll get to. And I was like, damn, this shit looks awesome. And, so I started watching that. But interesting thing. First, one note. One thing about TV and movies that's happening in a lot in the last few years. If you're watching a TV show, seems to be black characters are always in the way of whatever the show is protagonist. Like, I don't watch Friends, but I remember flipping through, and there's never black people on Friends, but when there was a black person, they were, like, in one of the Friends' way, or, like, if you're watching something, there's always, like, black people as the antagonist to the protagonist in the story, and this is starting to get on my fucking nerves, because, like, even in Judd Apatow flicks, whenever there's a black character, up until this is the end, it's either they're gay or in the way, was one thing I was saying. Like, Craig Robinson, he's gay. Like, the black policewoman in, Pineapple Express, in the way. And that's one thing that only if you're looking at it or for it do you pick up on this shit. But it's starting to get on my nerves because now Gilbo and Papina, whatever his name is, those are the two black guys who are questioning our leads. You know, and this is just something that I'm noticing as a trend that also came out there.
Yeah, and the thing is, to me, everyone's kind of a throwaway character outside of Woody and Matthew McConaughey. Because there's just so many people that you don't really see often. There's only 8 episodes, and they kind of do range all over the place. They jump in different time periods. And the only people that you kind of see in all 3 time periods are Maggie Hart, obviously, you know, Marty and Rust. I think you see Audrey, like his daughter, a couple of times. But for the most part, everybody else is kind of in and out. They're only involved in, like, one era of the way the story is told. Speaking of which, I did enjoy the fact that the story is told in, like, 3 different time periods, where it's like, you know, the modern day time period, and then, like, you know, the, like, old school, like, when they first got the case 17 years ago, and then, like, 10 years after that or something like that. I actually enjoyed that storytelling and how you can, they don't really, like, explain it, like, flat out to you, but you can tell by, like, just the wear and tear on their bodies and how they're aging, the makeup and stuff. I thought that
their
was
hair.
Yeah, the hair for sure. Woody Harrelson's hair was great. Matthew McConaughey's disheveled alcoholic look was pretty good. So,
All right. Well, here's the thing about the overall sense about True Detective is my overall takeaway from this, and I've only watched each episode, like, once, and just certain scenes a couple times, like the finale, and then, like, that episode 4, that long, continuous shot. But the thing about True Detective is there is a basic – the story is very, very basic, and it's wrapped around in a lot of good stuff that's happened. Because, like, it's a great location, great cinematography, great acting, and that clever technique of the time. Like, there's a lot of things they throw out you, but if you just look at the story and the elements, like, if this was just told linearly, like, you would be bored out of your fucking mind just watching this shit. Like, no matter how lush the scenery is, that time is one thing that expands the scope of the story and draws you in a little bit more. And I like how they did it, too. Even the fact that, like, as they're telling their tales, the way it's set up, if you haven't seen it, is that the two black detectives are questioning Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey, and as they're telling the story, we get the flashback. And one of the things that's really cool about how they do it is, like, in the flashbacks, you'll see something that happened that they're telling the detectives, but when we see the actions happening, they don't match up. So we see the lies that they're telling the detectives, and I thought that was a really cool thing.
It was, man. Like, there's a lot of cool storytelling elements to it. And then also, I think that they kind of fooled critics, apparently, and they're taking a big hit for that from the reviews that I'm seeing of the show now, especially after the finale Sunday. Like, a lot of people were really heavily speculating on everything. Like, you know, I've seen, you know, on the Slate, they had a discussion after the episode ended where people were like, well, I wrote a whole blog post on how his daughter's drawings on the refrigerator were supposed to be symbolic of some things that happened later, and they never did anything with that. And, you know, they're kind of like, yeah, the show really let me down. And I will say that I think maybe it's just our culture now with the internet and so many people like making their living off of critiquing media.
Yeah.
People have kind of like they were overly excited about the show and they overly praised the show. And now it's probably going to get overly taken down when I just think it was a solid show and not much more or less.
You know, this is Lost. Is because everyone got into Lost and was poring over every detail. And that was a show where they actually fed into that.
Right.
And also, much like True Detective, it was also its undoing, because as much as people were drawn into Lost and looking for all this stuff, when things weren't wrapped up, people were like, ah, you didn't let me down, and that's the thing that's now happening here. And sometimes it's just a fucking story. Just watch it and accept it for what it is and quit looking for more.
Right.
Being assholes.
Like, I saw someone that was like, yeah, the one of the shirts that one of the kids who had sex with Marty's daughter was wearing in jail was a devil worshiping like rock and roll band. And I'm like, okay, but why is that detail supposed to have anything to do with the actual murder plot? Like it wouldn't like that. Like, this is not a world where that's a clue. Like they've never set that up narratively where they cut back to last week and they're like, oh, remember that shirt? Like, so why is anyone writing a blog post about that shit? And if so, I don't trust your critical opinion of, you know, going, I don't like this show anymore. It's like, well, they, like, just a show for the show. The show has flaws all its own, you know?
Yeah. Now, if this was being written on costumeandwardrobe.com, then maybe they might have a little something.
Right.
But if it's on any jerk-off blog, whatever.com, then shut up. Shut it up. And another thing that I saw, because like I said, I watched it in a marathon. I didn't get into all the extracurricular stuff. I didn't bother, and I'm glad for it, because I saw you posted something up on Twitter, and I was like, oh, what's he talking about? And I clicked, and I was like, these people are nuts.
Right.
But one thing that I did see, because Slate had like a whole sidebar of a bunch of articles that came, and one of them was, hey, what's with all the nudity on these premium shows? And to that, I say, shut your fucking mouth.
Right.
Shut it up. Shut the fuck up. Because I'll tell you, the Woody Harrelson's little side piece, when she came with the shirt and the nipples poking through, I was like, ooh, we about to see some titties. And then when she pulled them out, she had some beautiful titties.
Yeah.
I was like, thank you, HBO. This is why I have this shit.
It was Alexandra Daddario. She's only in a couple of episodes, like I think 4 episodes. But them titties will live on in infamy for the rest of her life.
Will. Do you watch that show Banshee on Cinemax?
No, I do not.
It is not that bad, but the girl who was like the underage girl and the cat on the cat ranch, whatever, and then in the years later she was working at the phone store, then Woody Harrelson winds up banging her out too. She's also naked, and she's also on that show Banshee where she's an Amish girl who goes bad, and she's naked in that too. And she's a little cute little thing there.
Well, I feel like she's definitely moved up the list. Her next thing I'm sure will be pretty big, since people seen them titties now.
So
let's go in here and start talking about some of these episodes, man.
Real quick though, before we do, you were talking about the two black investigators.
Yes.
Interesting how they had the characters that appear and disappear. Lester Freeman from The Wire showed up real quick, and he was only in like an episode, and his presence was, I was like, all right, we're gonna get some Lester Freeman, and then he disappeared. It's like, okay. But interesting casting wise, Wood Harris, Avon Barksdale, was supposed to be, if not one of the investigators, he was supposed to have some role in this. So if it was Wood Harris and Brothers Muzon as the investigators, that would have been pretty cool. But Wood Harris wound up backing out, and we wound up getting Leroy from Sons of Anarchy. But that was just an interesting aside.
Yeah, and the dude that played the Scarface guy is actually from Boardwalk Empire. He plays the guy who plays Remus.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's where I recognize that guy from.
Because we saw Eli in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He was good.
So that HBO, man, they have their little nepotism going, man. They, like, you do a good job in another series, they give you work.
Yeah, well, they could have used Poot for, in that shootout scene or something. I'd like to see Poot get some more work. Last I seen dude was sitting in a Foot Locker. I felt a little bad.
Yeah, true story. His people emailed us to have him on our podcast a while back, like a year or two ago. He's a rapper now.
So, why wouldn't you do that?
At the time, I was just like, he wasn't on my radar. Like, I wasn't really looking to hear him come on to talk about rap. I wanted to talk about some of The Wire shit.
Oh, well, they were saying he was not going to talk about The Wire?
Yeah, yeah, the email was about, yeah, it was like, he want to rap now, so he wants to talk about this video and that. I was like, he probably not familiar with our show. Okay. But, yeah, man.
More power to you, though, Poop.
Yeah, yeah, good luck, man. It was very positive rap, too. So, episode one, The Long Bright Dark.
I'm sorry, one more time, Rod. Yeah. Sorry, one last aside, and I'm going to let you go. Okay. If we like the two black detectives, I know they're doing this Fargo adaptation for TV.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like the dynamic of the two black detectives, Key and Peele are going to be playing two, like, detectives in this Fargo TV adaptation that's coming out, like, pretty soon. So that's just another thing to look out for.
Do they get cast and everything together now? Because it's like the second or third thing I've heard where they getting cast together.
I don't mind it. I dig them. I mean, Peele, I like Jordan Peele of the two, but two of them together, they're cool.
It's funny because it's like the first time that Hollywood's ever decided that there can be more than one black funny person at the same time, but it has to be them together. Like, it's like, well, Kevin Hart's done. Now it's you guys.
Oh, did you see Kevin Hart and Jamie Foxx are making a movie together now? But this is getting off topic. Okay.
Yeah, good for him, man. Kevin Hart's making a movie with everyone. By the time end of his career, hopefully it'll be 6 degrees of Kevin Hart.
Hell yeah. Hart and Bacon.
Right. that's next. So yeah, True Detective, episode one. They show, this is when they introduce the narrative that they're going to be doing a videotape. It starts off looking like a videotape interview with the detectives from 2012, but then it kind of takes you into the tape and now you're kind of living it and you're seeing exactly like from their perspective, them telling about this old case about a serial killer that they allegedly caught. That's how we start off. We start off thinking that the serial killer has been caught and they're just reviewing the case with these guys because they expect that there's a copycat because now more cases are popping up. You see Woody Harrelson, who's got like a bit of a gut, bald head, older guy, and Matthew McConaughey is like the dingiest, just disheveled looking dude. Like, I don't know if he's... I saw him in Mud, and he wasn't this weird looking.
Is that worth seeing, Mud?
It's all right, you know. But he was I felt like he was dirtier in this movie than he was in Mud. And in Mud, like, he never sleeps in a house, you know?
Okay.
But, yeah, so they both are doing the interview separately. There's two black detectives who are asking all the questions. Detective... Thomas Papania and Maynard Gilbo, played by Michael Potts and Tori Kittles, kind of understated roles. They didn't really get a lot of dialogue to work with. It's pretty much they ask questions and then they get an answer that gives us a flashback. So they're more like narrative tools than actual characters.
Yep.
One
thing that they do set up, though, in the beginning is, like, for the people that are watching the show, we got these two guys, and Woody Harrelson is a massive extrovert while, you know, Matthew McConaughey is playing like an introverted kind of guy. So this is like for, okay, we're appealing to men. So what two types of men are there? Extroverts and introverts. Boom! Got them covered. And this is one thing I'm going to be pointing out while we're going along is that there are so many elements that are going on here that it's like a computer. Like, they said HBO went to a computer and program and said, all right, we need a miniseries and we need a whole lot of elements that are going to tie people in. And this is one of the things they did. Okay, you need two characters that can hit, like, if there's, like, split down the middle in your men gender, then extroverts and introverts, boom, we got that covered.
Yeah, and Woody's more of a family man, quote-unquote. At least,
but he loves pussy. You know, he has his chicks on the side. You know, he's like the dude's dude, alpha male type guy.
Right, yeah, and they set it up in the beginning to where it looks more wholesome. Like, I want to say in the first episode, they kind of introduce us to his family. He's trying to get Cole to meet his family, and we learned that, like, Cole has some demons in his past with drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. He shows up drunk to dinner with a bouquet of flowers in his hands, which is, you know, completely like an awkward thing because, like, one, who brings flowers to meet someone's family? And then two, he's drunk off his ass and, you know, which leads, you know, Hart to get offended because he's like, hey, man, you show up here drunk to meet my family. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
And this is the thing where it comes into another checkbox, because we find out later that Rust had a daughter and she wound up dying, which we're not sure if... how did you determine how she died? Like, it sounded like maybe there was a car that hit her. She was playing on a tricycle. There was an accident. It didn't suggest if the wife did it, but I take that away. It didn't take if he did it. It was just kind of ambivalent.
It sounded
right?
it was just kind of out there. Yeah, it just sounded like she got hit by a car, but
ultimately she's dead though.
Yeah,
and
her
so
dying
he gets fucked up
right.
Because he, and as he explains, is that he doesn't know how to deal with being around a family again because he hasn't done that since he lost his.
Exactly. And, you know, ultimately it sounds like their marriage dissolved because they lost their child and
they were blaming each other.
Yeah, they couldn't get over it, whatever was happening.
Which is realistic and expectable. Here's a question, though, one thing I noticed is like, because when we noticed that we were going to be doing this, I watched the first episode again just to get like back into the swing of it. And, one thing that, Rust says is he says, one quote that I liked, he says, "I lack the constitution for suicide." Which means, like, he's already given up at the point where Rust and Cole, I think this is them meeting, because they're just now, they're starting to have conversations. And this first conversation they have in a car, where they're talking about religion and the belief in God and all this kind of stuff, and he just busts out with, like, "I lack the constitution for suicide." Like, otherwise, I would be dead, okay? So it's like, all right. But then here's the other question. Where did the detectives find Rust in the first place? That was one thing I wasn't sure about. Because he's all living off the grid and, you know, just living by a bar, getting drunk all the time. How'd they fucking find him?
Yeah, and apparently they did know that he had this bar wherever he was staying in. Or whatever. They knew he had a place he was staying in. They just didn't have a warrant. Because they said they wanted to get in and look around, and he told them no. He said, if y'all do want something, he said, "You want to see something? Get a warrant," and walked out. So, like, apparently they knew his location, or at least, you know, that he was a vagrant or something, but they just didn't, they must not have had, like, he must have been shiftless. Like, he just wasn't showing up anywhere for a period of time. So they're asking him, so he has an awkward dinner, which, I thought it was pretty funny. You know, he tries to be sober for a little bit. And I picked up on it right away, the chemistry between him and Maggie.
Yes.
And I remember going, because, you know, they show that they don't like each other in the future. Like, when in the current, you know, the modern day, when they talk about each other, they talk about each other like you talk about a stranger or almost an enemy. And I was like, yo, that woman has something to do with that.
Yeah.
So I thought that from episode one.
But then also, too, you want to talk about things from episode one. I noticed when Woody Harrelson saw that chick that he was banging later, because she came in to drop off some files or whatever, and then he wound up going into another room. And then Russ looks around the apartment like, is anybody else seeing this? Mm-hmm. And then he's just like, all right, whatever. So, you know, that was another thing that was kind of telegraphed.
Yes, exactly. Yep, that was a great moment, too. Russ goes out and interviews some hoes. he's trying to track down some drugs so that he can
think he was looking to just get around the whores so he could find the girl, and that was like the ruse that he was going under, because also he was like a narcotics guy before he got into homicide.
That was
like the world he knew.
The crime scene of the crime scene of the original crime was, they figured out it was a prostitute, probably a prostitute. So they started trying to track her down and find out exactly where she worked. So he went to meet some prostitutes, and prostitute offered him some snatch. He said, no, I'm good. But he was hanging out with them. Then he also asked for some drugs. He was like, you got some downers? Cause he can't go to sleep apparently. So.
And that was another thing, too, how he did it. Like, he was talking to a couple of them, and he narrowed them down. He was, like, weeding them out to see which one was going to be a little bit more malleable than the other one. He's like, all right, you can go to the bar, get me a drink, or some shit like that. And then he was like, all right, you're mine, and then this is where the relationship... So it was, like, in that quick exchange, we essentially got to see how he picked up a CI, you know?
Yep. We cut back to Hart.
That's confidential informant for those people that aren't up on the lingo. All right.
We cut back to Hart, who apparently sleeps on the couch. Hadn't been home for a couple of days. Maggie confronts him. He goes, I don't have time. I gotta go back to work. Which, you know, it was funny because I listen to like different podcasts and people talk about this from the beginning. And a lot of people thought he was a good family guy. Apparently, he was just working hard. And I was like, I don't know. There's some hints that he might be a shitty husband and dad. You know, and that was one of them. The I haven't been around for a couple of days. Come home to catch a cat nap. And then your wife says, hey, where you been? And you're like, I got to get back to work. So,
you also have that whole trope of cops on TV where are there any good cop fathers? You know, it seems like they're all like, well, at least detectives, maybe guys on the beat, whatever. But detectives, they're always like, oh, I got to go work on, oh, this case is overwhelming me. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm bringing it home with me. Oh, my work's too much. Now I hit you. And then it's like, okay, so it's like you're kind of used to it. But
yeah, that's true.
You can also see where it comes to the frustration for Michelle Monaghan's character, because it's like she has to go out with him and see that he's such a, you know, jovial and fun guy to be around. Then when he comes home, he's not. So it's like, and that kind of comes up later. Like, why don't I get the you that everyone else is getting?
Right. So they go visit a church, because this hoe apparently has been going to church. And they think, well, maybe that has something to do with it. They talk to a priest who brings up
some hoes in this house of God.
Yeah. They talk to this priest. The priest brings up a case where there were two dead cats. This is the black church.
And that's Lester Freeman, who's playing the pastor.
And he says, he had some two dead cats that were found hanging outside the church. The priest also, they show the priest one of the objects that they found at the crime scene. And he calls it a devil's nest. Mm-hmm. So apparently, not only is this a thing that some people have seen before, but I guess it's not, like, it's obscure, but it's not that obscure. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean the killer has made every last one of these. Apparently, people make these
all the time. Like, it looks like a dream catcher, basically. You know, like one of those things that I think comes from Native American or something or other, maybe. But it's basically a bunch of sticks. It looks like, basically, if you saw the Blair Witch Project, that symbol of the sticks, things like that, and just different variations on that. Mm-hmm. But then this is also taking place, I believe, in Louisiana, right? So down there in Louisiana, there's a lot of this voodoo and Santeria, which is another thing Lester Freeman brings up. So when they introduce that, that's when you know, okay, so we're getting into this world a little bit. And one thing I like is that they don't go into like a bunch of like, you know, special effects, you know, crazy, nutty, you know, horror movie type shit. And they keep it grounded in reality, but it is reality that motherfuckers practice voodoo and Santeria and all this shit, and this is just an extension of that, which gets into the bigger story.
Right. They go out to this house, which has, I guess, some loose connections to the case. They talk to a woman there, and Cole goes and starts looking in the backyard, looks in the shed, boom, there's another devil's nest.
Boop, boop, boop!
Right. We go back to the modern day, and they show, Cole, and there's a picture of Cole, they show Cole a picture of a new crime scene with another woman tied up, and it looks really similar to the 1995 crime, and they want to know how it could have happened again if Cole and Hart caught the dude, and he says, you better start asking the right fucking questions.
Good
and,
line.
Yeah. And, like, this is one thing I will give this show. They know how to end the episode.
Yeah.
Like, there's always McConaughey saying something or just, you know, some revelation, and then the shit just goes to the next week, and you're like, that was good.
Yeah. One thing that happened in the first episode that was a good foreshadowing, too, is when Russ slaps that cop, the guy who winds up being the cop they come to, like, in the later years. Mm-hmm. And his name was Garachi, but he played Officer Mitch on Weeds, mm-hmm. if you're going by other characters these people play. And there's just a scene where he's talking shit to Russ, and Russ just walks up to him, slaps him in the face.
Yeah.
I thought that shit was fucking funny, especially how he winds up treating him a little bit later.
Yeah, that was amazing. They build on that theme, too. Nobody likes Russ.
Yeah.
Like, and Marty doesn't really like him. He tolerates him. Some of the best dialogue is what they have in the car.
Oh, yeah.
It's just the two of them. And Rustin is always going into these really weird philosophical veins about, you know, nihilism and atheism and all this stuff. And Marty, despite all his flaws, is a much more simplistic, moralistic type of dude, even when he violates those morals.
And he has no problem telling Russ to shut the fuck up. And one of the funny lines is like when they're in the car and he's like, when you come to my house for dinner, you do not say any of this shit.
Yeah. I can't remember which episode, maybe it's two or three, when he finds Cole cutting his grass. He said, "You do not cut another man's grass."
Yeah, and that's one of the things I wound up, because I was listening to the Slash Film podcast, mm-hmm. and I didn't know in that movie Kingpin that Woody Harrelson's in, that's a reference that he says. He says, "You do not mow another man's lawn," and then he says it again in this True Detective. So it was like a little, people are like, you know, another one of these bridges that get gapped, or gaps right. that gets bridged, or what have you.
So, episode two, taking
another... Attack of the Cones.
Yeah, I think this one was called Seeing Things. They basically, you know, still trying to do the same thing that happened. You know, we start with the flashback to 1995. They go to Dora's mother's house. Dora's the dead prostitute. Mm-hmm. They acquire by her father, hoping they can learn something about the family and the church she used to go to. They talk to Dora's friend Carla, who describes Dora as loopy and high. And apparently, you know, Dora is this chick who's, you know, in addition to being a prostitute, you know, they're like, she's going to church. She, you know, has some abuse in her history. You know, learning a lot about her without really meeting her. And every character they come into, which is, I kind of enjoyed about the show, everyone they come into, no one ever has a full story. Everyone ever has, like, they have, like, one fucking thing. There's, like, a five-minute conversation, and offhandedly they'll be like, well, there was that time that she did such and such. You're like, oh.
Well, yeah. We could have cut to that fucking chase, couldn't we have?
Right. I didn't need to talk about the existentialism of friendship.
Now, I'm not a huge fan of police. Matter of fact, I quite despise the police. But when I watch these shows like Homicide or even True Detective, if I could skip all the fucking police academy and being in uniform and all that shit and just skip right to being a detective, I would love to be a fucking detective.
Right.
'Cause that shit just seems pretty cool. Like, mm-hmm. you just have this intuition where you know, you're just sussing stuff out. And then, like, even later when Rust, like, people hate him, like, early on. And then later on we learn that people admire his abilities to, like, get down to the truth of people in the interrogation room. It's like, man, I would really like to be like the fucking detective, you know, figuring shit out and all that stuff. So,
yeah, and also detective, it doesn't hurt that detectives in movies and TV go off book. So, yeah. They're, you know, it's like a lot more quote unquote cool. They're not showing up in a uniform.
Right.
You know, they're just kind of like, you know what? Maybe we'll just say we heard something come from inside. We'll just bust in. Like
Vic Mackey shows up in a leather jacket and a tight ass t-shirt, and he slams somebody in the head with a phone book. Yeah, I'm with that.
So they learn that Carla moved down south. Later they find out that she went to a prostitution camp, which we visit later.
Sounds like somewhere I would like to go, actually. I mean, not to say I'm into that kind of thing, but if this kind of things existed and it was legal and I had absolutely no morals or gave a shit about what people thought about me, I would like to go to a whore camp.
You know what's funny? When I saw the whore camp, I kept thinking, this must be, like, the white whore camp, because there were no black people there.
Right.
And I was like, you know, it's far enough down south that, like, the black whore camp is, like, up the street another 5 miles on the left.
Nah. Actually, there's good work being mammies and maids and that kind of thing in the South. So, you know, they don't have to go to whore camp, you know.
Okay, maybe that's what it is. I also felt like they wouldn't serve my black ass.
Right, well,
at the white whore camp.
Yeah.
You lost, nigger? Whoops.
They'll charge you triple.
Right. So while droving, that's when Cole tells Hart about his daughter, how she died and the marriage failed and all that stuff. And Cole's basically like a confirmed bachelor. Like, he doesn't date, he doesn't sleep. Like, I mean, which makes sense. I mean, he doesn't seem like the dateable type. Like, he has a lot of demons, and you can tell, you know?
Yeah. Also, I wonder on the timeline, because they say he was into narcotics. Mm-hmm. So, the daughter dying and all this stuff, and he was in narcotics, like, for many years, it sounds like, because he did something, and he got thrust into narcotics, and they were throwing him wherever they needed him. And it's like, okay, so when all is this happening? Because now we're at this point, and plus we saw when he was into narcotics, mm-hmm. which we get into later, has no problem doing the drugs, so he can kind of manage that. Mm-hmm. But, and now he's having all these, like, he's seeing visions, and like, the lines are blurring, all types of stuff's going on, so he's got issues.
Yeah, he's got a really good impossible white man background, as I like to call it. A very loosely defined set of skills, although we know he is skilled. Very, you know, loose background. We know he's had to do some things to survive. And he does go about some impossible white man shit in this show, but, it's not an impossible white man show, obviously, but he does have several, like, moments where you're like, yeah, only a white dude could have the privilege to do that in a movie. We jump to Hart, and he's at a bar with some fellow cops, and he's telling them a story about hooking up with someone he pulled over. So now we're starting to get the cracks of, like, family man, might be getting out there. In the present day, that's when he tells the detectives that he had a lady that he'd hook up with on the side. And he argues that he had to do it. And there's a clip of this I can play.
You gotta decompress before you can go being a family man. What you get into working, you can't have the kids around that. So, sometimes you gotta get your head right.
He makes this gesture when he says, get your head right. When he, like, puts his hand to his head. He's just like, this dude's a piece of shit.
Well, that's sign language. That's guy sign language for, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Come on, man. You know, you got to see them titties. I was the only thing missing would have been if he literally described the titties. That would have been the best part.
Yeah.
You're like, God,
well, fortunately, we didn't need that. This isn't network TV. We're right on HBO, so we got to see him.
Yeah, that would have been.
Well, some others of them.
Yeah, as he showed the titties, he'd be like, listen, these titties were, you guys aren't going to believe me, okay? Then we find out that he's hooking up with old girl from the first episode or whatever. Yeah. She's younger. Pretty hot.
Yeah, she is.
Puts cuffs on him.
Yeah, she does.
After arguing with him, they have some, freak nasty sex, like, ate her ass out, didn't even take her out for $200 date. She tells him, like, you want your cake and eat it too, and he said, how good is the cake if you can't eat it?
That's a good point. He does make a point.
Yeah.
Dudes trying to get ass make the most sense.
They do.
You know, at least they try to.
So then we cut to Cole, and he's at a girl's house trying to get some Quaaludes, and it's that prostitute. And she tries to offer him some of the sex, and he goes, I'm good. And it was funny because she kind of asked him, like, well, you're a cop. Obviously, you're going to try to get some pussy, too. And he's like, nah, I'm good. She's like, yeah. You sure? He meets up with Hart, and he tells him he can smell the pussy on him.
Yeah.
Great line. It says you hooked up with somebody and wasn't your wife. Hart gets pissed, like, get out of my fucking business. Throws Cole up against the locker. Cole is such a cool customer. He basically is telling him, like, I could break you down right now, but I'm just going to let you calm down.
Yeah. And this is why, for the people, if you are extreme, and again, it goes to that yin yang, extrovert and introvert. So where you see the one guy going forward, the other guy's like, like Bruce Lee, like Wata. You know, he's right. Just like letting it wash over. He's like, all right, I'm gonna work with you. All right.
And it's funny too because Hart's getting out of control, and then like McConaughey just grabs his arm, like by his hand, just a little bit. Like, yeah, see this? That hurts, right?
That was a little impossible white man-ish.
It was
a little bit.
Oh,
like you know the secret Vulcan moves to, just grab somebody's wrist and they're all fucking decapitated. They can't do shit.
Yeah, well, my man Cole is an impossible white man. Like,
oh, okay.
Like, he has an impossible white man background. Like, I feel like the story before True Detectives, from 1994 to like 1988, I feel like that story, if Cole, they told that one, it's just like a fucking movie of impossible white man shit that he did when he was undercover, high on drugs, killing bad guys, and taking names. So, but that
snorting every drug and still being fully functional.
Exactly. Like, cause he has some hints of that in this series, and you're like, yeah, this is, come on, only a possible white man could do that. So they go to the Bunny Ranch. They go by auto repair shop, ask for help finding it. The guys at the shop don't know where it is. They walk out, and Colt says, I got some more questions to ask him. Goes back in, beats the shit out of these dudes, and they tell him where the Bunny Ranch is. Apparently, they knew the whole time. They just weren't going to tell these cops.
All right.
And that's the moments where you're like, I mean, obviously it's fucked up, but that's where you're like, and that's why detectives are cooler than cops.
Yeah.
Because he just walked back in there and was like, hold my jacket.
Unless it's your ass getting beat, in which case they're the biggest piece of shit on the planet, but yeah.
Exactly. Thank God none of the people that beat were black, so I was cool with it. At the Bunny Ranch, they questioned the owner, who's a lady, and they talked to one of the prostitutes about Dora. The prostitute is hella young, and it keeps it's bothering Marty a lot, which kind of like is the catch 22 with Marty, because like Marty's a scumbag, but he's not a complete scumbag,
right? Yeah.
You know, so he's like, "This, you need to get out of this." He gives her some money, which
I don't know what the fuck that's gonna do. Yeah. Why don't you go sign a lease? Oh, can't do that. Well, why don't you go get yourself a car? Nope, you can't do that either. Well, go get some bubble gum and fuck some more dudes, and we'll heal that wound. Go ahead.
He's upset that the sheriff already knows about the ranch and that the young girls are there. He thinks the sheriff probably has some money involved in it. We're finding out the sheriff might be kind of dirty or whatever. They get Dora's belongings. There's a flyer for a church she used to go to. Apparently, we cut back to Marty and his wife. They're having problems. They go visit like her parents and shit like that. And her mom,
love lost there.
Yeah. Her mom's concerned about the relationship. He's hanging out with the father. Shit gets pretty tense. And then he has to leave to go quote unquote investigate. And Maggie goes off and he's like, well, you all can stay here. You can come with me. So she comes home with him. And of course, shit gets even like more hectic at the house, and they have like a little knockdown drag out. Which I think culminated in him crying. I think this is the time where he cries. And I was like, that's the only thing that saved him. Was that?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
She was like,
that in that episode? Okay.
I think it was then that he cried. I can't remember. Cause I know it was before he got caught cheating that he cried. But he cries, and then she kind of like, you know, they go to overtime basically in a relationship. Every dude knows that trick. He pulls a Hail Mary out with the tears.
Yeah.
At the police station, a trio of men come in, say they're a task force. They're shutting the investigation down. They're taking it over. Hart and Cole basically like, fuck you. We did all the work. Y'all coming in here trying to tell us what we're doing. Their boss comes over and says, hey, y'all don't be assholes to these dudes. And he says, why is this case stalling out? You know, we got other shit to do. And they say, can we have the rest of the month? And I think he says, y'all can get like a week or some shit like that.
That's something that I never understand about cop shows. It's like, if it's so easy to stop crime, why are we even stressing anything? Right. You know what I'm saying? It's like, hey, we got a bunch of dead girls. You guys ain't figured this shit out yet?
Right.
I'm sorry, I wasn't aware. This shit was so fucking easy.
Right. Close enough, guys. Let's go. Wrap it up. They go to find a church. The church is burned down and all this shit. But on the walls inside, they find a drawing. Somebody with antlers on their head. And another great ending.
Yeah.
Here's some antlers. All right, guys. See you next week.
And I don't know if that's Impossible White Man, but Cole's just looking around, and look, let me pull back some of this ivy, and there's a drawing conveniently placed right there.
Oh, it's the gut feeling. The gut feeling is huge. I think this episode is also when he talks about his, the LSD, because he sees, like, the birds in the sky make a weird pattern.
Yeah, like, trails. And
yeah, stuff. So, or at least we see the visions. Maybe he doesn't say why, but we see that he sees shit, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's another part, which actually comes to play a huge part in the finale. But episode 3, The Locked Room. Cole and Hart are going to a tent church. Mm-hmm. And we meet...
Okay.
We meet Eli from Boardwalk Empire.
He's got some kick-ass sideburns.
Yeah, and he's doing his best Southern Baptist preacher.
That was really impressive and made an impression. Like, when he's throwing his hands in the air and got the microphone, it's like, yes, that is the spirit. Like, you are acting the spirit right there. I appreciated his acting on that.
Yeah, he was really good, man. I actually was pretty impressed by him as a character, period. I wanted him to be in more, but, you know, we only got him in a couple episodes, but, you know, whatever. So yeah, they give him, you know, he's ministering and shit. I think it's called the Bible Ministry.
Ministering and shit.
Yeah, I think it's called the Bible Ministry, which is like the most basic, name for a church.
And then also too, the dichotomy between ministering and shit. You also have, Cole and Russ. They have a, or the two guys, they're having a conversation in the back of the church about how, you know, Russ doesn't believe in, you know, God and all this other shit. And then, Woody gives him the fucking finger in the middle of the church as he then goes closer into the church.
Yes. Yeah. I love that. I loved, Cole's, like, nihilistic view on life. Like, I just enjoyed that a lot. Cause, you know, very rarely do we get characters like that. Very rarely do you get, like, a kind of an atheist type character like that, that is vocal about his beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I kind of enjoyed his whole, like, this is all shit. Okay, guys, yeah. Cut the bullshit. This is all terrible. And we're just doing the best we can while we're here.
Yeah.
So yeah, they view the sermon, have some different views on religion. The detectives go speak to the minister about the victim, and the minister's wife recognizes the victim, from a previous engagement. And Cole says, religion is the transfer of fear and self-loathing to an authoritarian vessel, which was a dope line, it was just, I don't know. He had some dope lines during this little part, man. Just Cole has bars. So Hart goes on a walk with the minister's daughter. They offer a couple clues about a man that Dora was seen with. Cole also talks to a mentally handicapped dude named Bert who'd have to rule out as a suspect because, apparently he had his dick removed.
Yep.
So even though he did have some type of past with some children or something.
And you know, there's a line, like, people are complaining about the titties in, the HBO shows, but I don't hear any complaints about the eunuchs in HBO shows, because Game of Thrones has one, and now we got another one here. No one wants to see titties shown, but no one got a problem with people cutting off dick and balls.
Yeah.
Come on.
Right. Not to mention the random amount of dicks in Game of Thrones. So, speaking of detectives in present day, Hart says Cole's theory that the murderer was a serial killer is what led him to their man. So that was like, you know, kind of a thing. Cause at the time they were investigating this as a one-off, but Cole from the whole start was like, this dude's a serial killer. And you can see like he has a journal and a book with all these drawings and shit. And they're kind of setting us up at this point to lean towards, well, maybe Cole was the killer the whole time. And he was manipulating this, manipulating this investigation from the inside. And that's why the killings continue, is because Cole is somehow secretly killing all these people and can't help himself.
Red herrings are what they call them.
Yeah. Like, I never thought, I never bought that. I was like, it's obviously not him. Like, it's
because even in like promotion and like when you're watching commercials, you can kind of tell, like, they give it away.
Right.
I don't even think they intend to sometimes, but sometimes you're watching a trailer for a movie, you pretty much know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And if it's not even laid out, you can just tell. Mm-hmm. And this didn't happen here. So that was like when they kind of threw it out there a little bit, I'll wait till you get there. But like, yeah, I wasn't buying that.
Cole mows the lawn in this episode. Hart is not cool with that shit. He invites him to stay for dinner though, and he turns it down. Maggie invites him to stay for dinner, and Cole turns it down, and that's when Martin runs outside and says, "Hey, dog, you're not supposed to be here when I ain't here."
Mow another man's lawn.
Yeah, and McConaughey plays this role so low key, so it's like even in the middle of this, like Marty is yelling at him, and Cole's just always like, "Come on, Marty, come on." Like, it's always that low key, like. Never excited, never yelling back at anyone. It's just completely laid back. So,
and then also after he's making his accusations, when he walks away, he just walks away, just like very still, shoulders. You know, his hands weren't even swinging when he walked; they were just down, and he's just walking away. And then that's what winds up spurns, you know, Woody Harrelson into being Family Guy, because after that happens, then he's got the daughter on his lap, and mm-hmm. this is when we find out about the drawings and this, you know, the theoretical shit, you know, the theory monsters start going crazy.
Yeah, his daughter drew some naked people.
Yeah.
And Maggie basically said, this is because your ass ain't never home. And she confronts him about, you know, their distant relationship, why things have changed. She thinks something's up with him, and he won't come clean. This is when he cries. My bad. He says, I think I'm all fucked up. He says, yes, you are. She starts crying. Then she kisses him. And I guess they start fucking. Back at work, they interview several burn victims who match the description of the suspect, but they don't get anywhere because the only description they have is that the dude had, like, scars on his face or some type of burns. But they don't know exactly who he is, so...
Get closer.
We find out Cole is great at getting people to make confessions.
Yeah.
They said he says he can tell in 2 minutes if somebody's guilty or not. Impossible
white man.
Yep. Just, you know, that's another impossible white man skill that doesn't get enough credit. Just walking into an interrogation room, asking 3 questions, and the person being like, yes, I killed him. Of course.
Which is then why when you see, like, the lieutenant or the captain or whatever higher up says, why haven't you solved this case? Well, we just haven't figured it out. Yeah, but you can tell in 2 minutes who does it or not. So chop, chop.
Right. Did you ask the 3 questions or not? They go on a double date. Hard and Maggie. This is the sloppiest shit, dude. They go on a double date with Maggie and Martin and Cole and a new woman named Jennifer. A pretty attractive woman. And Cole, you know, he looks pretty well kept together on this date, you know.
He was in there not drinking and everything, you know.
Right. So, Cole is, you know, hanging out and he's calm, but Marty sees his, side chick with a new dude and decides to go over and confront her, at the bar. And, you know, it's one of those moments where like, the way that movies show things now, people are kind of used to it, but, like, 2 characters are talking, and it seems like the rest of the world, it just doesn't matter that they're talking, but in real life, you'd be like, everyone would be looking at these 2 people. Well,
now, I know I'm not married, but if I was at the bar talking to a woman, my wife would immediately ask me when I came back, who were you talking to?
Right.
Yeah, bitch.
Especially talking to her intently. He even grabs her arm at one point. Like, she goes to walk away, he grabs her arm to pull her back to finish the conversation. It's like, who does he, like, this is so, all I can think is this is so embarrassing to her, his wife. You know, they finally get a night out and then this shit happens.
Yeah. But then also too, when he goes to the bar, the girl Lisa comes up to him. It ain't like he goes up to her. Like, he goes to the bar and she excuses herself from her dude and then they proceed to talk and she's feeling on his face and he's grabbing on her.
Crazy.
Seamless.
So after they leave the bar, Hart gets all liquored up, storms into his side chick's house, beats up her date while trying to find out if they hooked up. The dude, he calms down, apologizes, says that he's not crazy. I think the dude even said that he didn't even get none. Like, it was something like, she just sucked my dick or something stupid like that. Or he asked him, like, did she suck your dick? It was something crazy like that.
I don't understand why I need the details, but whatever. Okay, yeah, I'm thinking straight. All right.
Did she juggle the balls? Did she juggle the balls?
Did she put the first tip of her pinky in your butthole?
Admit it. Right. No, that's how she gets down. So the next day, Cole goes to work on the serial killer theory, finds another victim who he believes is part of the serial killer, like history of victims. The most solid proof is that there's a spiral symbol on her shoulder. So now they get a little bit more time to work the case. The case that they were supposed to already have stopped working. Cause that's pretty much the only thing that their chief does is show up and go, hey, you guys done with that case, right? It's like, we can't do it. We're still working on it.
You got a couple more days, Captain.
You got a couple more days. God damn it. So they, drive out to talk to Henry, who's the old victim, the one they just found out about, grandfather, who leads him to a younger guy named Reggie Ledoux, who she was apparently dating. They look at Reggie and they realize that he must be him because he's got drugs. He's in cahoots with Charlie Lang, the ex-husband of one of the victims. Apparently they were in prison together. But he has like this history of some weird shit. And they're like, okay, this must be the dude. We just need to find him now.
And that's another impossible thing that happens. Like, they go looking for a guy they've presumably never met before, and they're driving over a bridge, and then his boat is going under the bridge, and then Matthew McConaughey's like, there he is. I see him on the boat. Like, what? How did you tell this dude that you've never seen before is on a fucking boat, and you know that he's here, and your car's going over the river at the same time? But that's another thing, too, about those Louisiana. I love the way they talk. Like, those, hey, man, he got, well, I can't even do it, but I love that drawl and that, hey, you know, just matter-of-fact way of speaking with that accent. I dig that shit.
We also get probably the most iconic image of this series for me, the image of a dude in his underwear wearing a gas mask holding a machete stomping through the middle of the woods.
If I had a nickel for every time I seen that shit, ugh.
Right. Welcome to Louisiana. That was that. So next episode, we'll see. What was the name of this shit? Episode 4 is...
That is going to be...
The Super Bowl.
Who goes there?
Oh, okay. Who goes there? They took a week off for the Super Bowl, so we come back. Heart and Cold.
Or if it's my case, I went and got a sandwich and then came back.
Yeah, yeah. Heart and Cold interrogate Charlie, who apparently was the dude to trick them about Reggie or Diddy. I don't know. Charlie seems just as pissed about Reggie being a suspect because Charlie basically, like, that was his ex-wife who gets killed by Reggie LeDoux, according to them. But Cole is like, I don't believe you. Like, you're a piece of shit. I know Reggie is, Reggie be cooking up that meth. I think that you were in on it with him. And it's real fucked up because, like, I want to say the end of the interrogation, like, the dude even said some shit, like, you know, kind of like leaning towards, like, genuine concern for the victim.
Yep.
And Cole, like, hit someone with some cold, I forget what he said. There's some cold-blooded line, like, you know, like, this your fault.
Yeah, the gist of it is, yeah, she dead because of you. Yeah.
Yeah, if you would have shut the fuck up, she'd be alive. Because apparently when he was roommates with Reggie LeDoux, they used to talk about old girl, you know, in detail. And he says, well, that's why he got out and targeted her as one of his serial killing victims.
Yeah, your fault.
Live
with that, motherfucker.
Right. They learn of a place that Reggie likes to go to do devil worship. And you hear about the spiral symbol and somebody that Reggie hung out with named Tyrone. They go out to find Tyrone, and I'm thinking, okay, here we get our first brother of the series.
And they had to go Scorsese with it because black people were introduced. Okay, here's Nigger mm-hmm. Tigger. Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you. Glad you threw that in. Hope you're happy.
Well, they go to find Tyrone, but first, Hart is in court over a case. Sees his girl Lisa, who the last time he went in there, went to a crib and beat up that dude. So, like, his side piece sees him. She's a court reporter, so now we know how they met. And she's basically like, hey, you can't be fucking disrespecting me like that. Going over to my crib and shit. And he tries to, like, you know, pull the swagger out on her. Like, look, bitch, I'm a man. And I'm going to do what I do. It don't have to make sense. Now, you don't shut the fuck up. And he forgot rule number one, which is that if you have...
Bitches be crazy.
Mm-hmm, any sexual relationship is a relationship. And there's always a way to hurt you. And she decided... like in the elevator when he confronts her in front of all these people and basically says well, you know, you need to respect me or something. He said, this is me respecting you or some shit like that. And I was like, oh, that wasn't good, because a woman scorned, right? But we'll get to what she did later. They go out to find Tyrone with the help of the whole station. They're all looking for him. Hart gets bothered by Lisa because she goes and tells Maggie that he cheated on her.
Yep.
Maggie packs up her shit.
Suitcases by the door.
Yep. Says for him to leave the house. He tries to go to the hospital that she works at like a crazy person and confronts her. And at first this scene, I love the way this scene is filmed, by the way, because he confronts her and then this doctor steps in and goes like, sir, you can't be there. He's like, I'm a police officer. I'm a detective. He says, are you here on police business? And he's like, okay, well, then you're going to have to leave. And then they cut away. But then when they cut back, he's still there. Because, like, they had this moment earlier where the doctor says that, and it looks like that kind of de-escalates things. Like, where he's like, you know what? I got to go. But instead, it's like, no, fuck that. I'm staying, and you're going to forgive me.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't work out as well for him.
Nah, it doesn't. He just causes a scene. And Hart follows a girl connected to Tyrone, because Cole comes and gets him, I believe. No. He gets drunk and he follows the girl. That's right. He goes drinking in his car, and he follows a girl from the strip club to to a party to where she meets up with Tyrone, who, surprise, surprise, white dude.
Oh, I got the wrong dude. Okay, I was thinking Tigger.
Yeah, Tigger. Tigger the nigger comes up later, but Tyrone being a white dude completely blindsided me.
Yeah.
I was like, what? Oh, apparently HBO didn't want to cast no brothers.
That's like, because I always want to do a production and have a character named White Jerome. Just because I like the dichotomy.
Yeah. So he slams, they do some creative investigation tactics, slamming his head. And Tyrone says that that Reggie is cooking for a motorcycle club exclusively called the Iron Crusaders. Hart tells Cole, that's when Cole tells him about, hey man, I used to be undercover. I got this crazy history of, you know, drug use, undercover work, narcotics. I'm like a, you know, I was pretty much an impossible white man back in the day, and I'm about to have to do some impossible white man shit to get our fucking man. So, you know, Hart goes and said, they show Cole getting ready. Like, he's open, looking in his little mirror thing. I don't know what that was about. On his wall, he's like opening up a box with guns in this shit. Like, he's about to go A-team on somebody.
And that was another thing, like, I watched, because after the episodes, they have the interviews of the guy who wrote it. Mm-hmm. I forgot his name, blah, 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 blah. And he was saying how when they made the chest, they were like, how much shit do we want to put in here? And they're like, we want to put some shit in here, but not enough to make it seem like, you know, he's a one-man fucking Rambo or anything. Mm-hmm. But it was still a hefty chest. And then he started getting into, like, the drug. He started making the fake track marks on his arms and shit. Like, it's like, damn, he ain't fucking around.
And it's funny, too, because as a dude who has a history of alcoholism, one of the things in the chest is just like a big ass bottle of bourbon. Just like it's like AK-47, a 9,
grenades.
Yeah, hollow tips, and of course, bottle of bourbon.
But see, that also goes to show him, because he wasn't drinking. Like, when they went out, he wasn't drinking. I really don't think there was any signs of him drinking up until that point when he's like, he opens up the trunk. That means Crash is coming out, which was his name when he was an undercover guy. Mm-hmm. And so along with that comes the alcohol, because the next thing he's doing, he's making a fake track marks, and then he's testing the cocaine in the evidence room and all that shit. Mm-hmm. So it's like, once that, you know, the case comes open, all the ability to take in and ingest all this stuff gets open as well.
Yeah, he stole cocaine from the evidence room. Like,
and he said, well, it's got to be a better system for doing this or some shit like that. It's like, yeah. But then the point is, it was the 90s when, you know, that was the end of there being, you know, swipe key cards and all types of tracking and everything. So,
So Hart goes and talks to his wife again. And this is when he really is begging, you know. But she's not having that shit. He tells, he gets Cole gets a call from the hospital to come get Hart. They go to a bar. That's where he tells him he knows the Iron Crusaders. He's gonna need some personal time to drop some lines at the club. And basically says, I'm about to go undercover again. Hart moves in with Cole.
Yep.
Now that his wife kicked his ass out. And the present day, Cole doesn't even tell the new detective, the detectives, that he infiltrated the Iron Crusaders, because, like, all this shit was off book.
Yeah.
Like, from this point on, like, the lies are so blatant in the interrogation, which actually gives you a lot of respect for the acting, because the way he told those lies were so good, I believed him.
And then also, too, the fact that they corroborated each other's stories was just like, all right, even though these motherfuckers despise each other at that point in the future, they still are sticking to the story. Like, right. There's like a code, you know, honor among, you know, cops or whatever, or partners at least, where we're going to stand by each other no matter what.
Yeah, it's what it was like. His father was sick. He went to go visit him and shit. And you're like, wow, these dudes, they got their lies straight.
Yeah.
And I guess for people that get lied to for a living, they should, right?
Yeah, you would think so. Except he couldn't do it when it mattered with his wife.
Right. You know. Yeah, he couldn't cover that shit up. So he took a leave of absence, quote unquote, infiltrates the Iron Crusaders. Cole meets with Maggie, at a diner, mm-hmm. and tells her, cause she still cares about Marty. And she's checking on, like, his well-being, and he tells her, like, he wants to see the girls. And he says, kids are the only thing that matters. People fuck up. We age. It's not supposed to work except to make kids. And I like that Maggie basically was like, yeah, you're just now another sanctimonious cop telling me to let this shit slide. Mm. Which was cool, because it's like he's supposed to be so... the other guy, you know what I mean? The guy with the offbeat opinion, the guy, you know, the well actually dude. And she basically was like, this is the same bullshit that any of other guys who work with Marty would have said.
Yeah.
The two detectives have a meeting before they head to the motorcycle club. This is actually pretty funny to me. Cole's not feeling too confident about how it's going to go. So he basically tells him, like, here's a cell phone. Here's how you use it. Keep it on you. I'll let you know if shit doesn't go right. Stay out front. Don't come in. And it takes like 5 minutes before Cole is like, fuck this. I mean, Marty's
that
like, fuck this.
Never fails to annoy the shit out of me. When a partner says, hey, stay here and don't, you know, do it. And the person's like, no, I'm going to go and do it. And he fucking goes. And that always annoys me. No matter what movie or TV, I hate when the partner fucking goes. Because he could be fucking this shit up. He doesn't know. Because as we're watching this, you know, Matthew McConaughey's in there and he's talking to the fucking guy. He's making his way. He's starting. He's even doing the drugs. And then here comes Matt, you know, Woody Harrelson. He's going to fuck his shit up. And it's like, no, no.
And he almost does fuck it up.
Yep.
Like, literally, if he wasn't leaving, like, if he wasn't on that boat the second that Woody Harrelson got accosted at the door, yeah, that would have blown his cover
entirely.
Oh yeah. My god, I was so
all of this out. And he, because of that fucking too much, not following the rules, man, follow the rules.
That whole scene stressed me the fuck out. Also the drugs that Cole has to do to maintain his cover are laced with like LSD and shit. Like, he's fucked up. Like, whatever this brand of cocaine has in it, it's like the new shit. Cause he gets hit with this shit right here, nigga, this shit. So he's out of his gourd fucked up. And, of course, the bike gang says, also, let's go do a crime.
Yeah.
It's like a,
cause basically the setup to get to the guy who's making the drugs for the gang is like, he's using his undercover skills and he's like, Hey, I got this hot shit and, why don't you introduce me to this other guy? And the guy, Ginger, who he's talking to, he's like, all right, I'll introduce you to the guy, but you gotta come. I mean, I need a gunman. I need a trigger man. We gotta go do some shit. And, that's how he gets wrapped up and on the boat to go and do, you know, this thing. That needs
and
to
Ginger,
be done.
Ginger doesn't want to work with him off the book cause he doesn't trust him. Cause apparently he screwed somebody over last time and they're still looking for him. And like, if they find out that people are working with him on the low, there's going to be problems. So he's like,
Marty for some reason.
Yeah, Marty.
Who we never wind up meeting.
Yeah. So they're just like, let's cut Marty out of this deal. All we got to do is, you know, he's like, we can do that, but you got to go help us, with this thing. So, Ginger asked him to go help get some drugs in nearby neighborhood where they're posed as cops, which I thought was fucking hilarious. Cause that's pure racism. Those dudes look like the antithesis of cops.
They look like Duck Dynasty or ZZ Top, and they're just walking around with cop uniforms. Like, if they even put on all black and acted like they were SWAT, I would have bought it more than if they were in cop uniforms.
Yes, like it made no one thinks those dudes are cops. So they get high. They introduce them to Tigger the Nigger, cause we need some racism.
Right.
to complete the set. No HBO show is complete without it. They kidnap Tigger, take him to the dope house, like set up, like they're trying to hold the guys to get some money out, of a safe in the dope house. and apparently things go wrong because these guys are all super high bikers who are harassing four super high bikers in cop uniforms who are harassing a neighborhood full of black people.
In the worst conceived plan and possibly possibly anything I've ever seen. They're going to go into the middle of the hood as these four dudes, well, not with Matrix style, with bags of guns and everything. No, just as much as you can carry. A couple shotguns, which, you know, there's a shitload of rounds and shotguns. So, yeah, you got that going for you. And one of the cool, and this is done all in one, like, Children of, what's that, City, no, Children of Men. Like, it's all done in one long, continuous shot, which is beautifully executed.
Yes.
It's beautifully done. And the way that, like, the way the camera snakes around, you can see the outlines of the people coming, you know, coming up to the house, like, as all the shit's going down, then a rock is thrown through the fucking window and everything. Mm-hmm. And you're just, it's just like, the tension is mounting and mounting. And then, of course, somebody's gotta get shot, which brings up the tension so much more. And it's just like, tension, 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 tension. And then Impossible White Man shit happens.
Yes. 6 minutes of straight, like, Sam Fisher level of hiding from bad guys while also beating the shit out of Ginger, who he's using as a kind of hostage, but keeping, you know, trying to get him out at the same time. And don't
forget that he goes from one house to another house and then gets to the house and then uses, there's a big deal with their plans of getting to a phone and calling somebody. So he gets to the phone and he's like, "All right, man, I'm gonna need you to be at this intersection in 90 seconds. Go!"
Right.
And
yes.
So these two white guys are walking. First of all, why does Matthew McConaughey have a gun to Ginger's head? Like, anybody in the black neighborhood gives a shit that, you know, he's gonna get shot. And I know it was to keep Ginger in line, but it goes weird because later on, he's like letting Ginger run on his own. He's just following behind him. So it's like, okay, but whatever. It was still beautifully done and we got what was happening.
Yeah, it was dope, man. Like, what a great scene. And that was perfectly filmed. And they basically get away with Ginger. And I also love that he's like, "I should have just did this shit in the first place."
Yeah.
Like, I love it because that's how I was feeling. Was like, well, this was incredibly dangerous for nothing.
Yeah.
Could have pulled a gun on this motherfucker 50 minutes ago. We'd be on episode 6.
Then that would only been a 7-episode miniseries.
That's true. So yeah, man, action sequels is dope, and that's how they ended. Is they, you know, throw them in the car and drive off. So episode 5. What was the name of this shit?
Secret Fate of All Life.
Yeah, some of the names of this shit, man.
Heavy. Yeah.
Yeah. The episode begins with Cole and Ginger, who they captured, trying to get closer to Reggie. So, which is another funny moment because, like, all this shit that Cole's doing to go undercover, and it's like pretty much fruitless.
Yeah.
Because he goes to this meeting with a beat up Ginger, and they're talking to another guy named DeWall, and saying like, "Hey, we want to work with we need to get in contact with Reggie. We want to work with him directly." And the dude's like, "Fuck you! I don't trust you. You got one of them faces." And, fuck you, I'm not doing it. And it's really like, they did all this shit for nothing.
But, you know, then the guy takes off and they follow him.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know.
But it was just so funny, like, cause they made it seem like, well, they'll just talk his way into it. No, he won't. You're gonna have to beat this dude's ass too.
But I also appreciate that shit doesn't always work out like you're intending it's gonna.
Yeah, it's true.
Because if it was all too easy, then, you know, I mean, some of the shit was a lot easy, but at least some, it wasn't everything. And then they go into, like, the chase, and there's, like, the booby trap shit.
They lied to the black detectives and say, "Oh, it was gunfire everywhere. It was, people were over love with this, and there was that." And then they show them in real life, and they're just, like, quietly walking through the woods, slowly looking for booby traps. They basically make a decision at the time, like, "We're gonna go in, like, fuck that, we're going in together." Cause he tries to send Hart back. And says, like, "Hey, you go back, cause I'm about to impossible white man this shit." And Hart, his inferiority complex is like, "I'm impossible too, motherfucker."
Yeah.
So he stays, they both run up on the compound,
The thing that's interesting, though, too, because as we're talking about these things, I keep having, like, the episodes playing in the background. I'm, like, fast-forwarding up through the scenes. And I'm watching the scenes as they're going in the interview in the present day. And And then, like, as they're shooting back to the things that actually happened, the way you can kind of tell now that you know, they're kind of acting a little bit. They're putting it on. You can't tell if you don't know, but now that you know, like, McConaughey is acting a little bit different. Woody's behavior is a little bit different. It's cool how they did it.
They go to the compound. They get these two dudes, who are, you know, Reggie LeDoux and,
DeWall.
They end up having. Did they shoot one of them first, or was?
Well, they shot at him, but yeah. There was like landmines all over the place.
Yeah, he runs into a trap,
and right. He blew up.
He ran into a landmine, blew himself up. They get Reggie LeDoux sitting out there, and he says some really cryptic, weird shit to Cole, which, you know, makes you kind of feel like, okay, this guy must be the serial killer.
Yeah. Plus inside, he's got a tattooed noose around his neck.
Yeah, inside, Hart opens up a crate, and inside the crate are a little boy and a little girl, some children. They're malnourished. There's a bed, like they've obviously been getting fucked or something. And Hart walks out of the house, and Marty just shoots this motherfucker right in the face, in the head.
Yeah, yeah. Which was awesome.
Which was awesome, because I feel like every man has had that moment where you just read a news story or you hear something horrible and you just like,
you gotta die.
Kill this motherfucker.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe it's not, you know, the most long-term approach to something, but that is how you feel. And that was like a good catharsis just to see it happen. Like, hell yeah.
Because this sidebar, this is how I feel about life. I feel like a lot of shit would not go down if motherfuckers would just call people on the fucked up shit that they do. Mm-hmm. Excusing fucked up shit is why fucked up shit continues to happen. Mm-hmm. So after Woody Harrelson walks up, shoots the dude in the head, this is when I like, McConaughey was just like, all right, I'm with this, and now let's cover this shit up and work it out.
Yeah.
And that's when they set up the scene like, okay, let's make our story.
Immediately. And they stuck to that lie for 17 years or some shit. It was
amazing. And then we see a shot of them talking like a review board or whatever, and they're telling the fucking story. Like, they had told the story at the review board, like, in the past, they told the story to the detectives now, and the story didn't change. Yep. Dig that shit.
So, basically, the case is closed. Maggie and Hart get back together.
Oh, but don't forget about that cool shot of them walking the dead kid and the other kid, like, out of the fucking, you know, back into civilization. That was a really cool shot.
Yeah, they totally hit that Kevin Costner and the bodyguards with the Maggie and Hart get back together. Audrey's still having problems. She drew an inappropriate picture in class. She got caught hooking up with two guys in a truck at the same time.
She's throwing that pussy around.
Cole is a successful interrogator. He's going around interrogating people, and you know, ultimately everything's kind of going back to the same, but this is where the new detectives kind of reveal that they think Cole is the dude. Mm-hmm. They start asking Marty about Cole more like suspiciously, like, so he ever killed anybody, you know, shit like that. They take a picture. He's been at the crime scenes, apparently, at the crime scenes, and the cops take photos of him. So now they're thinking, like, maybe he's looking at his handiwork or something.
Yeah.
And to me, I thought it was obvious at this point. Well, he doesn't think the case is closed. He's still watching to see if this is authentic or is this a copycat.
Yeah.
I thought that was obvious, but, you know, apparently on Twitter I saw a lot of people thought maybe he did do it or something.
They're stupid.
Yeah, basically. During this revelation in 2002, we see Cole revisiting the abandoned school that we saw earlier in the season, because the case is over. He's still investigating it. We're looking around after his O2 interrogation gig, where he hears again about the Yellow King, which came up, you know, earlier during the investigations. Mm-hmm. I believe it was the convict dude that told him about the Yellow King, and he didn't really go into much detail. And so this new person they were arresting was like, y'all didn't get the real man. The Yellow King is still out there, and he fucks that dude up, which completely, like, really
goes against his grain.
Yeah.
Everything we've seen up until that point.
Yeah. And it also, like, makes that interrogation invalid and that confession too.
Yeah.
That person was like,
but
yeah, I killed
him. Not only
him.
That, it makes everything they've done invalid. Exactly. So, I mean, not only in that instance, but in terms of, like, if everything that Rust is doing is to catch this dude, and you're thinking they're getting closer, and it turns out they're not even close. I mean, that, him, he snaps. Like, yeah. They were getting the kudos and the accolades, and it turns out it's all bullshit, which is his whole thing. Like, it's all bullshit. He was celebrating. He was going along with it. He was, like, one of the guys. They were appreciating him. He was a taxman. Not like, fuck you, taxman. He was like, yay, taxman. And he was with it. But then he abandoned his original thought of, this is all bullshit. And now he's drawn back into, oh, wait, no, this is all bullshit. You're the guy that's fucking making me realize it. And then he fucks him up. Yeah.
Yeah, man, it was, that was really insane, man, because, like, at that point, I mean, you knew that there were, what, 3 episodes left, so it couldn't be the end, but I guess just seeing how it unraveled him, because it was gonna, like, to everyone else, this shit was closed, and it was gonna become his obsession, because he's always been about the truth, you know, amongst all this shit, so, episode, where are we at, 6 here,
Nice. Oh, don't forget, the guy he was talking to winds up dead in the fucking cell.
Yeah, oh my God.
Threw a little bit of shade his way.
Killed himself, fell into, like, some type of,
search or something.
Yeah, something, allegedly, because it happens off camera, and then there's just blood everywhere.
Yeah.
And later when we find out that there's connections with this serial killer shit all the way up to, like, I won't say the governor or some shit. You're like,
okay. Senator or congressman or something.
Yeah, like this shit could have, you know, could be a conspiracy. Could have got killed.
Definitely is.
One
other point too. When, he gets the call, Woody Harrelson gets the call that his daughter was out whoring. He brings her home and says something. It always confused, well, not confused, but another thing that kind of bothers me is like, he says, well, she's out there whoring. And then he says something that maybe wasn't cool or something, but still, the wife is like, how could you say that? And she goes off to, you know, but as opposed to being like, why are you out there fucking 2 dudes in a car? Ah, what are you doing? Like, it's like, there should be a point of, you know, let's kind of throw, you know, let's get her shit straight.
Cause daughter says something to him and he slaps her too.
Yeah, he did slap
her. But she said something to him. Like, it wasn't like he just walked in the house and slapped her. He was pissed, but then she said something that I can't remember what she said, but it was like, okay, well.
It was mostly like, why are you taking the moral high ground right now, Chinese finger cuffs? You are not in a position to do that. Stop it.
Yeah, like you earned this slap. Like, let's
not
be honest.
Not that I'm co-signing domestic abuse. Okay, go ahead.
Right, but sometimes you gotta slap a kid. Okay.
Spare that rod. No, fuck that. No.
So, episode 6, Haunted House. They go, Cole's investigating a link to the Tuttle schools. He seeks out Thiriot, I don't know how you pronounce that. Thiriot? Anyway.
You're on your own there, buddy.
Who has since, he's a dude that quit the ministry and became a drunk. He's, the dude from episode,
Eli from, Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah.
Episode 2, maybe.
So he's like, I quit. He says he basically quit because if he didn't want to tell him at first, but eventually he's like, I found out that there were some pictures of dudes fucking these kids and doing some fucked up shit to kids. When I brought it to the main dude's attention, he accused me of doing it at first. Then he said he would do something about it, and nothing ever happened, and the school got closed down.
That, to me, was the first sign that this was like a larger conspiracy. Mm-hmm. The fact that this guy, who was so devout, and they crushed his fucking belief. It's like, oh, shit, what the fuck's happening? And then he's talking about he found the tape, so that's actual evidence of something being corroborated by someone else, you know what I'm saying, by a credible source, and it's like, okay, shit's getting deeper. So it's cool.
Cole tries to interview the girl that they saved, because the little boy died. But he tries to save the girl that they saved from the trailer, and she is institutionalized and she can't talk. Like,
she freaks the fuck out.
Mm-hmm. She just said it was a man with giant scars. When he tries to get details, she just starts screaming about the scars. Despite being ordered to stop, Cole meets with Tuttle. Tuttle is like this big time preacher and head of all these schools.
Yep.
And very well connected. He scares Tuttles with all this stuff, which is funny because I love how the conversation is so less interrogationally, whatever, you know, like, it doesn't feel like an interrogation, but it so is. Like,
but it is, yeah.
It so is. Like, they're being nice and polite, but it's so like, yeah, so y'all was fucking these kids and y'all covering it up. I think we lost the records in the flood, you know. Mm-hmm. He's basically seeking the names of the people who worked at the
schools.
Yeah. Worked at the schools.
In the program, yeah.
Toto tells the department, misrepresenting the nature of the meeting, basically making it look like Cole came in there and jacked him up. Cole cites this as proof that Toto's obviously in on it.
Yep.
But he gets suspended from duty. Hart runs into Beth, who's a former underage prostitute that he was that he gave that money to. She worked at a bar. It was funny because he had like just bought a bunch of shit for his family. He still had the bags when she like hit on him.
Yeah, bag of tampons. So yeah, it was like, good guy, man. Yeah.
Good guy, but you know, he couldn't quit the pussy, man. It's hard to quit.
She was cute as shit.
She was looking good. So he started an affair with her. Maggie checks his cell phone while he's in the shower and finds a picture. Apparently, she sent the first ever sext.
Yeah, because it was on a flip phone.
Yeah.
So, whatever.
Nokia brick with a sext on it.
Yeah.
So she goes to Cole's apartment, and seduces Cole, who's drunk. He's laid off, basically suspended at the time, disgusted. She basically kind of tricks him into fucking her. It's not sexy at all.
No.
Look like a sex scene off of Girls.
That is the first time I watched a girl getting ready to disrobe, and I was like, no! Like, it wasn't like I was doing it to be funny. I couldn't control myself. I was like, no, don't take your clothes off!
Yeah. It wouldn't be as bad if the sex isn't always weird and disgusting. You know, like,
honestly, sex kind of is weird and disgusting. So on that level, it is. I kind of see where they're going with
it. It is, but that's not why people watch TV.
That's true.
They have a way of making it look, you know, not as bad. But, yeah, it was bad. She immediately, like, pulls her panties up. Cole realizes he got played. He's disgusted, mad at Maggie. She tells him she had sex to get rid of Martin because now he can't ignore this. Because when she tried to break up with him in the past, he just Cuban beat all that shit. It's like, we staying together. Maggie tells Hart anyway, who attacks Cole in the department parking lot, and Cole quits the force right afterwards. Well, I love that scene. With they're like, hey, Cole's coming, and he just like goes to his desk, quietly takes off his jacket, takes off all his jewelry, like he starts unbuttoning his shirt. He's like, I'm going to whoop his ass. Oh, that scene just feels so good. And then you know, Cole just basically throws him into the back of his truck and breaks the tail light, which he never gets fixed.
No, right? Because even we see it in the future, and they have that shot of the back of the truck.
Yeah. So in 2012, after the interview, they interview Maggie, who's now remarried and looked like she married rich.
Yeah, she did good for herself.
You know, she's scornful of their motives. She's sticking to her lie.
Yep.
Denies anything about Cole or fucking him or that he was weird. She says he's a good man with integrity. Hart abruptly walks out of his interview when they suggest Cole may have killed Tuttle in 2010, because Tuttle apparently is dead now, mysteriously died. I want to say, I can't remember if it was drowning, but it was some mysterious way that he died. My man, Cole thinks it's suicide. He thought, he knew that Cole was going to expose him, so he killed himself. Cole follows Hart and initiates their first contact since the fight. Cole asks Hart to buy him a beer, saying they should talk. They agree, and they turn away, and you see that Cole had his gun on him. I mean, Marty had his gun on him the whole time.
Like, yeah, he was ready to go.
He was like, that fight might have happened 10 years ago, but he still is a little untrustworthy. He doesn't trust Cole a little bit.
But that was an awesome ending to another episode where he's driving away. Mickey's driving away, and then he just hears honking, 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 and there's the pickup, and there's Russ chasing him down. It's like, that was good. He's like, hey, man, you gotta buy me a beer. No. I gotta buy you. You gotta buy me a beer.
Yeah. That was awesome. But, yeah, when they cut away, he's putting that revolver back. You're like, damn, that shit could have went real bad.
Yeah, and I'm actually, this is the scene that I have right now. It's like, there's such a great shot. It's a wide shot of the two cars, and there's the way everything is framed, and now McConaughey is getting out, and he's looking at him in the rear view, and Woody's going, grabbing the gun. It's just so good. So good.
So episode 7, After You've Gone.
After You've Gone.
2012, Cole prods a disinclined heart to assist him, and, just basically saying we didn't catch the dude with the facial scars. Cole is like, we also owe it to this town and everybody because we let this monster get away. He's been out here doing this shit. We can't ignore this shit. And I enjoyed that. He takes Hart to a self-storage facility where he convinces him, that there's a cult.
And Hart still wasn't convinced at this point, but he's still skeptical. So, okay, I can buy that.
I like that Hart walks into the storage building with his gun drawn.
Yeah.
Like, it's just Marty in there. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, but he doesn't know what's going to happen, and it's dark as shit. And I like the way they shot it, because McConaughey just walks into darkness. Mm-hmm. So, naturally, you're going to go for your gun, because you haven't seen this dude in years. You don't know where it stands. Last time you saw him, you left him, you know, fucked him up. Yeah. So, yeah. Makes sense.
It's just so funny.
I bought it.
Oh, I believed it. It was just funny, because, like, there was no pretense. He, like, pulls his gun out, is like entering it like a crime scene.
Yeah.
And then Cole cuts on the light, and he doesn't even like have a problem with the fact that Marty did that. It's just kind of like, yeah, I get it. You know?
Yeah. But that's the same way he's always been. Even like with the, you know, I'm on man's lawn, he just walks away.
Yeah.
With the fight in the locker room, all right, chill. You know?
So Cole admits that he burgled Tuttle's home.
And that's another cool scene when he's showing, like, yeah, I staked him out for weeks.
He like
and,
a ninja.
Got in their security system, went in their house, got the shit.
He like a ninja.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's
impossible
such an
impossible white ninja.
Such an impossible white man. I think that's why I ended up enjoying this shit, despite some of the flaws, is because, end of the day, impossible white man, you got me. So he goes in there and steals some shit, and part of the shit he stole, some photos, and a videotape.
HS tape.
And he tells Marty to watch it. And apparently whatever happened was so sick, he's like, okay, now I'm on board.
Yeah.
We got to catch these motherfuckers.
Yeah.
And
that's kind of my problem with the thing. Like, at the end of it, they were all congratulating themselves at the end. But in the end, they caught one guy. On the tape, there looked like there was a good 8 or 9 dudes.
Mm-hmm. Apparently it was like a cult. He denies killing Tuttle. He basically says the others probably thought Tuttle was going to get blackmailed over the videotape, which was now missing, so they killed him.
Yep.
So he couldn't get blackmailed. Hart finds a Ledoux relative who confirms that Reggie and DeWall were connected to the man with the scars. They locate a former domestic who used to work for Tuttle's father, Sam, when they still lived in the Vermilion Parish. She recalls a scarred boy that was one of Sam's illegitimate grandchildren from his other family, named the Childress family. Hart also discovers that the Vermilion Parish deputy originally handling the Fontenot disappearance was Hart's old friend and Cole's antagonist, Steve Garassi, which leads to a really cool scene where he goes golfing with Hart, and it's really interrogation over a game of golf. Like, I like those scenes where we're doing something, but really I'm asking about this shit.
Yeah.
And Garachi apparently concealed this shit. Like he was covering a missing girl's case. He just closed it. He said something like her aunt and uncle said he was living with them, so it's the end of the case. Hart basically goes, yeah, this motherfucker lying, calls Cole, they kidnap Garachi, pretending to go on a fishing trip with them, and while they're out in the water, Cole just shows up with a gun, like, yeah, dog.
That was one hell of an acting job, because Woody Harrelson was acting really, really buddy-buddy with him. Yes. I was buying it until and then it's like, he ain't even turned the tide. He was just like, oh no, I ain't gonna do that guy right there, you gotta talk to.
Right. He's like, why don't you just stop asking me about this shit? He was like, well, I don't have any more questions for you. But he might.
Yeah.
McConaughey and them interrogate Garashi to get the details. Meanwhile, Gilbo and Papania are lost trying to locate the rural church that Cole mentioned in his interview.
Who do they come across?
And they ride across. They come across the man with the scars on his face.
The sloppiest fucking painter in the world.
Yeah, apparently has green all over him sometimes. He says, my family's been here a long time. Long, long time.
And, message.
Right. Right. And he says, I'm the yellow king. I'm the killer.
Then, right.
But, you know, that's how the seventh episode ends. Another great ending. But it was just so funny because Gilbo and Papania are so fucking lost. And it's like, these motherfuckers thought they was going to find somebody. No wonder they thought it was Cole. It was the easiest fucking solution. You know, it's like, we hope it's Cole. That way we don't have to do any more work. We are terrible at detecting. We're lost.
And I'm glad there's a good thing there's not a backwoods incest defamation league that exists, because there's a lot of backwoods fucking going on in this movie, in this miniseries anthology. And I feel like if like the Asians and blacks and whatever, if there was a group that defended backwoods incest survivors or backwood incest performers, they would be all over this shit. We don't appreciate the representation. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Also, there was a scene in here where Maggie goes to the bar to ask Cole about how Marty's doing.
Yeah.
And basically says, don't get him killed.
Yeah. Which and, shows she still cares, which is nice.
Yeah. So, you know, apparently they're still cool or whatever. So, final episode 8, which was called Form and Void. And this is where a lot of people got really pissed. Okay. So basically, they've caught up with their Scarface monster named Errol, at his home in the middle of the woods with his lady friend who's just messed up as he is.
Actually, before that, he's actually at a school painting.
Yes.
And this is what really fucks it up, is because he's painting and he's perfectly clean. There's no paint on his coveralls. There's no paint in his fucking ears. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's discovered in episode 7, either 7 or 8, is that Woody Harrelson's looking at the picture and sees some, and Matthew McConaughey says something about green, and he notices that the paint on a house is faded, and he's like, maybe it was green. Huh, maybe when this person said there was a green monster with paint all over the place, it happened to be this person. Just the way that whole thing came together was where, like, all the reality just kind of went out the window. Like, it wasn't enough to make me be like, fuck this True Detective shit, but it was like, that's a bit of a stretch. Bit of a stretch for me.
Yeah, it was cool, man. But it didn't make sense. Yeah, it was like one of those, like, okay, I guess sometimes it just gets lucky, right?
Yeah.
You know, they put this whole, well, maybe if he wasn't a good painter, maybe that's why the girl said his ears are green and all this shit. And then apparently he talked to this dude at some point in 1995. He was more in the schoolyard, but he missed the clues he needed to connect him because the dude was sitting down and Cole couldn't see how tall he was. And his face was too dirty for the scars to be noticeable. So even they missed him.
So be it.
You know, whatever. They figure it out, going through tax records and house painting and all this shit.
And don't forget when, with, Giraldi, when they're after Garacci, after he's, get off the boat, he pulls a Walter White a little bit.
Yes.
With the hand in the air and the fake sniper. Well, actual sniper really? In this case. That was a nice twist.
Yeah, he basically tells Garacci, like, you're not going to, because he's like, now I know you're going to get a hankering to, like, you know, try to swing some
drop
dick on
a dime
this.
On somebody, some shit.
I believe the correct phrase is swing some dick on this. Which is the second awesome thing that McConaughey said another time. He's like, well, with all that big dick swagger you walk around with. He's talking to Hart about his cheating. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so he's like, I know you
don't. But then he lost points, though, later when he said, Lachaim, fat ass. It was like, all right.
Yeah, he was trying too hard then. But, yeah, he was trying he was basically saying, like, you're not going to do shit. And here's why. I got a sniper who's going to fucking kill you if anything happens to me.
But I'm curious what kind of cop is riding around Louisiana driving a Maserati. That's a little. There should be an internal affairs investigation into that shit alone.
He said he confiscates it from people that they pull over.
Okay.
So he takes other people's cars. He said that when they were golfing. I was like, really? What a piece of shit. Like, cause I just pictured some brother, like, getting pulled over for no reason.
What brother do you see driving a Maserati in Louisiana?
There's a reason you don't see brothers driving Maseratis in Louisiana. Cause they get pulled over by the cops. And they're confiscated.
Now see, if Garashi pulled up in like a big fucking 79 Impala with fucking M&M's airbrushed on the side, then I'd be like, okay, I see you took this shit.
He finally took, Chris Paul's car from when he was there. They threatened him, which I guess kind of ties up that loose end, because, like, I guess he's not going to do shit now, because once that sniper shot his car up, even though he was still mad, it's like, fuck you going to do?
That's a hell of an argument, though, getting your fucking car shot up.
Yeah. Also, after they threaten him or whatever, they also tell him that if they disappear, the media will get reports of all the shit that that happened.
Yep.
So they better not, you know, it's not in anybody's interest to kill them.
Yeah. Anything happens to us, everybody knows. Yeah, which is fine.
So they go to Errol, they get ready to head to Errol's house. They try to call.
Oh, don't forget though. Mm-hmm. When they see the green house and they figure out, oh, it was green paint. Maybe someone painted the house. Then they go to a woman who lived there maybe what, 20 some odd years ago. And they're like, hey, do you happen to remember the guys who painted your house 20 years ago? Now, I like to think that I'm a decent, like, I'm a black guy who tips as well, yeah. So I'm good to the person face to face, you know, if somebody comes and, you know, does something, I'll break them off a little something, but I do not remember the face of the people that do these services. So for a woman who's already old as shit to remember the people who painted her house 20 years prior, that was another little bit of a stretch, but okay, we'll go with it.
Well, if their face was scarred up, you might remember.
Okay. Alright.
They go to Errol's house, they greet her by, apparently his sister, we later find out, who they've been fucking or making flowers, as she likes to call it.
A little less disgusting than girl sex.
Yeah, it was really, really close for me. Like, just the sounds of their sex fucked me up. They're having some type of incesty type sex. His father is tied up, chained up to a bed, apparently. He tells him, if you're good, I might get you some water around noon. So,
it's weird. Yeah. It looked like 7.
It did look like 7. Very depressing. He walks by a TV where there's black and white English program movie on. He adopts an English accent and talks so well in the English accent. It was weirding me out how good that his accent was.
This is something that I did not know, and I only learned this from listening to a podcast. But like, they did another like this. They did a all encompassing thing, and they were saying like, this is something that did not come through on the thing. But apparently, the guy with the scarred face had a problem talking, and all he had was TV shows to watch to learn to speak properly. And so this is one of the things that he did. So he'll watch whatever he watches, and he'll pick up talking like that.
Oh, okay. Cause like,
so that's like, how the fuck were you supposed to know that shit?
Cause his regular voice was fucked up.
Yeah.
He did that, and he was like, spoke. It was meticulous, like how well his accent was. They go to the house. Marty, before they go out, basically talks to the 2012 black detective Papania and says, "Hey, man,
you
want us to call you when we go bust these motherfuckers? Cause we're going to go bust them." And they're like, what we want you to do is just, you know, tell us, you know, that Cole did the shit. And he's like, look, you can get the call or another motherfucker can get the credit. What you want to do? And finally, dude is like, all right, I do want the credit. Like, all these principles and shit went all the way out the window. All the suspects, like all that shit went out the window for,
Everything on a dime.
Yeah. Fuck it. I would like to make my career on this. So
yeah.
They say, yeah, they'll come out there and, you know, get their back if they need to. So, they get there. Marty asks, he says, we need a phone. I'm not getting cell phone reception, which I think is all like, you know, a ruse to kind of, I mean, well, maybe he must not have gotten cell phone reception, but the fact that he went to that house knowing that what was supposed to be going on over there or whatever. The woman who answered the door was the sister. She didn't want to let him in.
And then she says something ominous because she seems a little, you're not supposed to say retarded anymore, right, but she seems a little backwards in the head. Mm-hmm. And so she says, he's going to get you, or some evil shit. Yeah, and it's, he's like, the damn,
worst,
bitch.
He's the worst person there is.
Ugh.
But
you're fucking him. So yeah. How is he the worst person and your lover at the same time? Just like, come on.
Making them flowers on her.
That was disgusting.
There's also a part where I think he tried to kill that dog earlier.
He threw something at it.
Yeah, but it barely got away. Like, he was still going after that dog when it left the house.
Yeah.
And part of me felt like if he could have got his hand on the dog then, it would be dead.
Yeah, it does wind up dead eventually.
Yeah, he opens. So, Hart basically opens up the door. He's, like, looking through the house. The woman goes and runs in the tub and hides from him.
And that's when she says, he's coming after you. Mm-hmm. He's worse than anybody.
All of this juxtaposed with Cole, who's looking through the catacombs of like an old southern fort, Confederate fort, looking for Errol, who,
by the way, as a big dude,
yeah,
fucking dipped quick as shit because he saw him. He's like, get on your hands and knees. He's like, I don't think that's going to happen. And how come every serial killer has that voice? Silence of the Lambs to now, they all talk like, yes. So, and then he's like, I'm not going anywhere. And then he takes off like a fucking running back.
Yes.
I was like, how the fuck is this guy who's been lumbering around the whole time? That dude took off like the Flash.
Yes, he got the fuck out of there.
Looking forward to that.
Also, hell of an interior decorator.
Isn't he? I mean, all those little dream catcher, whatever, little stick figures made life size.
Yes. Like, he actually had a skeleton-looking thing that had, like, all kinds of decorations around. I said, look at this guy, man. Like, he really missed his calling.
Yeah.
And he was so good that he was able to talk to Cole, and Cole couldn't get his bearings. Like, he was, come die with me, little prince, and shit like that.
He figured it out that all the twigs and shit that's growing around, they make sound travel, and it became the most acoustically perfect, you know, structure in all of the world.
Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
And also, it turns out that it's also it says because it's Louisiana, in Interview with the Vampire, it's also the same place where they put Kirsten Dunst when the sun came over and turned her to ash. It was the same room, which
really?
Is really interesting.
I didn't know that.
No, that's bullshit. But ultimately, there was a circle in the sky where the sun could shine through.
Yeah, and that actually fucked Cole up because he had one of his LSD visions.
Yeah.
Which they set up earlier because when they're traveling to the house, he actually says, Marty Smith says, you still get those visions? And he goes, they never go away, man. It's just something you have to get used to or whatever.
Yeah.
That's
the way I feel about my beauty. It's like, you know, shit happens. People always want to come up to you, man. How do you live like that? Being so beautiful. I'm like, just some shit you just got to get used to.
Black don't crack. Yeah.
McConaughey is having his fucking vision. Then Errol comes out of fucking nowhere, fucking slices his hand, kind of sort, and stabs him in the fucking gut like Jack on Lost.
He doesn't just stab him in the gut. He stabs him in the gut and is lifting him off the ground simultaneously. Yeah. Like, he has this dude levitating a good 7 to 8 inches off of the floor, holding him up, and you just realize how fucking massive this dude is.
And then also too, McConaughey then headbutts him 4 times, and how do you, like, I'm figuring with a knife in the gut, it takes stomach muscles to pull your head back and thrust it ahead 4 times. Like, that's some impossible white man shit
right
there.
Yeah, for sure. He should have died, for sure.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Hart has found the father who's tied up and looks emaciated. I didn't even know if he was alive or not.
And this is another thing that I heard on the podcast was that because they're in Louisiana with all the humidity and all that shit, if he was dead, he would have been decomposed a long time ago.
Okay.
So he is alive.
Wow. So he's alive. He puts the phone call in, apparently, finds the phone. They don't show the phone call.
You never see that,
but
right?
Obviously, it must have happened. He goes after Rust, follows him into the room. And right as Rust is getting, you know, stabbed up, he shoots the dude in the shoulder, and the dude pretty much shrugs that bullet off.
Yeah.
And throws a hatchet into his fucking chest.
Yes, he did. Yep.
Nigga, what?
And then, here's two things. If you have people incapacitated with blades sticking out of them, and you go to kick them, as he did to Rust and as he did to Marty, why wouldn't you kick the knife or just jab that shit in further? You don't just kick them in a fucking random spot on their body. You want to inflict as much. If you're going this far, inflict as much fucking pain as you can to your enemy.
the fact that he could throw a hatchet and hit the dude, like, I was just like, they gonna die, you know? Yeah. I wasn't putting it past the series to just kill both of them in their catacombs, and we never find out what the fuck happened. But
it wasn't until we saw brain chunks fly off his skull, because, Rust winds up getting the gun and then shooting him in the dome.
Yeah. Man, that was crazy. But that was a great scene. Even though it was short, it felt like it lasted forever.
Tension.
Yeah, I was like, these motherfuckers are dead. They're dead. They're dead. They're dead. Oh, my God. You know, the whole time.
Okay.
Oh, they lived. And then I'm like, how are they going to get out of there? They're dead.
And also, I was ready for them to be dead because this isn't an anthology. Last episode, these are huge stars. They ain't got time to be, you know, devoting themselves to TV. So you know they're going to get different stories. So if they died, we weren't certain that they were going to survive.
Yeah, and I thought they were going to die even after killing the guy. And, you know, that kind of be the end of it or something. But they showed the cops did get there. We cut to the hospital. Hart's family comes and visits him.
Which was nice, because apparently he's been estranged from them a long time, and he did not expect to see him.
And he starts crying, man, like, to know that they still care after all that time. And it was kind of a cool moment, you know, and I feel like that was the catharsis for the character, because after that, he really wasn't a dick as much, and he actually seemed kind of zen. Like, he was willing, because Cole is still a pretty much a dick, and he was willing to put up with a lot of Cole's shit. Like, in the hospital, like, all the scenes there, Cole, like, when he comes to visit him, Cole's like, what you still doing here?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, he's like, okay, asshole, I was coming to check on my friend, you know?
And even then, like, Marty was, when the daughter came around the bed, he's like, oh, I don't smell cum on your breath. It's so nice of you to come anyway. You know, it was very good of him.
How's the porn career going?
Yeah. Because she does have, like, the dark eyeliner, which suggests she might be, you know, through Hollywood makeup sending a message, she does still look a little bit like she might be up to some shit.
Mm-hmm. So they go outside and then they have this really existential talk where Marty tells them, like, hey, we didn't get all the men, obviously, but we got our man. And that's all that matters. Like, that's the victory.
Another thing, too, that in terms of not getting all of them, is that in the news report, they say that Errol was caught and that they had ties to this big family, but there is no clear connection between the two. So it's kind of like, ultimately, the big power structure won, and their little victory was exactly that, a little victory, and I guess they just had to be happy with doing whatever little bit they could.
Exactly, yeah. Several pieces of evidence at the scene were linked to various murders, but they don't say, okay, this is the Tuttles also, and there's a connection to the governor or whatever. They just kind of go, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so then they have this really deep existential talk about, apparently, maybe when he was having his vision, or maybe when, you know, after he got stabbed at some point, Rustin was having a vision of basically, like, going to join his mother and father, all this love. He was going to basically die and be happy, and he wanted to go there. Like, he didn't realize at that moment, he's been so nihilistic the whole time they've been talking, but this was his moment of, like, I wanted to basically go die and join the universe. And it seemed like he didn't realize he had that inside of him. He said, all I had to do was let go. He says, even more than before, he felt nothing but love there, his daughter's love. That was when, he said, he was talking about the light versus the dark is the whole universe. And he's like looking at the sky, and, Hart goes, well, the dark has a lot more territory. And Cole says, well, I disagree with that. Once there was only dark, so you asked me the light's winning. Which was pretty cool. And the two just leave because he refuses to stay at the hospital, apparently.
Yep.
The two just leave, and that's the end of the series.
Yeah, the end. But, I mean, at the end, you know, it's, I don't know. What
do you think about the existential ending and all that shit?
I mean, he was existential throughout, so for him to abandon it would have been not accurate. So it had to go that route. And also, you know, this is a big undertaking, so you know the writer wants to throw a little bit of, you know, metaphysical whatever in there. So I was with it. And plus, I like the speech about, you know, the feeling of being with the, just experiencing love. The idea of this guy, because ultimately that's what is missing in his life is love. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that this guy was able to feel love again, and he's going to continue living, was like, okay, I'm going to live, and I know that there's love, which means there's hope. So, you know, so be it. And he's able to put aside the case. So that's how he comes out a winner. He's able to put aside the case because all that time up until the interviews of today, he was not able to let it go. So now he's able to let that go. He understands that love exists and he's moving on. So it's a good ending for him.
Yeah, I enjoyed the ending too, man. Apparently some people thought maybe he found God or something, but.
Eh, it wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, no. I think if he would have found God, it would have said so. Like, I don't think it was. You know, and I think a lot of people got lost in some of the quote-unquote word salad of the way that he talks.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really feel that I had a problem understanding him. Now, I also watched this whole series with closed caption on.
And, there you go.
I don't feel bad rewinding shit either. I think too many people don't watch with closed caption and they don't rewind or whatever.
It's like admitting to no one that's around that you're not as smart as you think you are. And it's doing a disservice to yourself.
It really is, because they put a lot of little shit in there where you're like, so that's that guy's name, or, you know, whatever it is. You know, there's a background conversation, and you're like, oh, that I wouldn't have heard that. I didn't have my TV up loud enough. Yeah.
So, do you watch Community?
Yes, I do.
Well, actually, this was on The Suit, but Joel McHale and Jim Rash did a parody of True Detective, and yes. They pretty much do that on the fact that you can't understand anything that they're saying, and when you can't understand what they're saying, the shit doesn't make sense, and I thought that was kind of funny. And then a lesser True Detective parody was Jimmy Kimmel and Seth Rogen did one. So if you're into any parodies of True Detective, check either of those out.
But yeah, man, overall, I enjoyed this series.
Letter grade, what do you give it?
I would say is a solid B. Okay. Maybe B plus.
I go B minus, but okay.
You know, great. I thought the acting was well done. I really appreciated it being short.
Like, I don't think 8 episodes?
Yeah, I don't think this shit holds up for 13 to 20 episodes or whatever, but nah, I think 8 is perfect.
Yeah.
I think the reason I enjoyed it a lot is I never had any illusions that it was going to be grander than it was. It always felt like a cop drama to me that was just a little fancy.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing. And like, for as many of these hood movies that were, well, at least made in the 90s, and I'm not talking about Best Man or shit, or The Wood or anything like that. I'm talking like, another, like, Master P level shit, where it looks like they're shooting that shit with, like, a flip phone. Like, if you took the same stories and did it with, like, cinematography, all of a sudden it would go from being some cheap, shitty hood movie to being, oh, the plight of the African American and some, you know what I'm saying? Cinematography goes a long fucking way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially.
That's why even these Tyler Perry movies are looking better these days.
And the special effects that they did use.
Minimal.
They were minimal, but they were perfect. It was, hey, these birds flew in a circle.
Yeah.
That's it. That's special effects. Like,
or then when he's in that room and you see the, you know, what looked like the universe, whatever, before Errol attacks him. Mm-hmm. It was minimally used and it was used for good purpose. And it wasn't like supernatural. It was what we already know is going on in this guy's head. So, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was a big fan of what you said. Letter grade, you give it a B minus.
I go B minus.
Okay.
B minus closer to B, but B, yeah, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't ideal, but it was good.
Yeah, so it was like a.
All right, I'll go B.
Okay, yeah, I was gonna say, like, I feel like it's a definite step above, you know, your C programming.
Yeah.
You know, it was well done, man. I think critics got a little heavy into it and like.
Really, yes, very much so. Very you know, much so.
Like
there's
I hate
a lot
that
of things
happens.
That get these critical dick suckings, and I'm like, I'll kind of go like the what was this Grand Budapest Hotel, this Wes Anderson flick. They were all over that shit. I don't even know a theater where the shit's playing, but they're all over that shit. And I know that shit's not gonna be good because what was it, Moonrise Kingdom? I tried watching that shit, and I'm like, what the fuck is this? There's a lot of times that critics they just go, they're lemmings. A lot of times they get into a lemming mindset and it's just like, you're just wrong.
The thing that,
I mean, it's all subjective, but still.
The thing that did that for me last year was American Hustle, which I, I enjoyed, but then I walked out and I went, that's probably a B minus film.
Yeah.
And I walked out and everyone's like, not only is it A, it's an A+, and it should win all the awards. And I was like, okay, nah, fuck this movie.
Exactly. There you go.
So, but I think that's what's happening to True Detective a little bit. You're getting a little bit of that backlash of people going, all right, guys, it wasn't that great. And then you're getting the other people who are like, I thought it was going to be the most epic thing ever, and it turns out it was just a good show. So
how
fuck
about
this
your
show.
Expectations are failures,
right?
Because you clearly don't know how to make them.
Yeah. You know. So I enjoyed the show. Be happy to discuss it with anybody. But like I said, this is another episode of Off-Season Reviews. Make sure you check out Lamont on Twitter, LS Rules,
and Tumblr.
LS Rules on Tumblr too.
Also, yep.
All right, so make sure you check them out. I'll put links to both of those in the show notes.
And that will be the name of the podcast coming to you some point in April.
Mm-hmm.
Keep an eye out, folks.
So there you guys go, man. 2 hour off-season review of True Detective, man. Didn't realize I had that much to talk about. So
1/4 of the length of the actual show.
There you go. If we would have been doing these weekly, this shit would have been like 16 hours worth of talking right? about an 8-hour show. This is why off-season reviews is the best. All right, guys.
I know you're talking about. I know you're trying to clip. Mm-hmm. Do you watch Arrow?
Yeah, I watch Arrow.
Okay, good, good, good. Because that's actually pretty damn good, actually.
That show might, that off-season review might take forever because I love that show. And there's a twist like every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But all right, man, we'll talk to you guys later. Peace out.